number one of a story entitled The Boss in the Wall, a treatise on the house devil by Avram Davidson and Grania Davis. The date right now is Thursday, May 30th, 2002, and it's about 9 minutes after midnight. I'm going to read the introduction to this story. First of all, the story is being read from the 10th anniversary edition of the Mammoth Book of Best New Horror, edited by Stephen Jones. Copyright by Carolyn Graff Publishers, Inc., New York. It's copyright 1999. This is the introduction by Jones. Avram Davidson, 1923 to 1993, needs very little introduction. He was one of the great voices of imaginative fiction, the author of more than 200 short stories and many longer works. He won the Hugo, Ellery Queen, Edgar, and World Fantasy Awards, including the latter for Life Achievement. He was also nominated for the Nebula in every category. Grania Davis was Avram Davidson's former wife, lifelong friend, and sometime collaborator. Her fantasy novels based on Oriental legends include The Rainbow Annals, Moonbird and Marco Polo, and The Sleeping Beauty with Davidson. While her short fiction also reflects her travels abroad. Although Avram Davidson's work was largely out of print at the time of his death, Grania Davis has undertaken to get his fiction back into publication, helped by friends in the SF and fantasy community. With Robert Silverberg, she co-edited the 1998 collection, The Avram Davidson Treasury, which included 38 stories, each introduced by a noted author, while The Investigations of Avram Davidson, co-edited with Richard A. Lupoff, is a recent collection of mystery stories. What a long, strange trip the boss in the wall has been, reveals Davis. Avram had a weird dream in the early 1980s. I don't remember exactly when. The dream became a rough, sprawling, 600-page-plus novel manuscript about a strange creature in American folklore. When I first read it, it blew me away. After Avram's health declined, I set to work to complete the novel, as I had already done with Marco Polo and The Sleeping Beauty, 1988. Aside, in classical music, completed by is a recognized byline. Different versions of Mozart's Requiem were posthumously completed by different living composers. Perhaps we should consider this usage. There was interest in the Boss novel, but editors changed positions, and somehow the book never got published. Avram began to work on a novella-length version of the story, but that also slipped through the cracks of the publishing process. After his death, I really wanted to see Boss in print. I began the job of completing the novella, incorporating important segments from the novel, including material of my own. This version was supposed to be published in a fine magazine, which promptly ceased publication. Was Boss jinxed, or what? Finally, Jacob Weissman at Tachyon Publications in San Francisco rose to the challenge. He published the completed novella, The Boss in the Wall, a treatise on the house devil, with thoughtful introductions by Peter S. Beagle and Michael Swanwick, and a truly creepy cover by Michael Dashow. Boss was placed on the ballot by the Nebula jury, which reaches out to smaller publishers like Tachyon. What a great surprise. The Boss in the Wall is a powerful, strange, funny tale. This was Abrams' last major work, along with Virgil III, The Scarlet Fig. Boss has been well received, as I always hoped it would be. To quote from the story, "The dreadful secret, so long concealed, has begun to escape from its dreadfully long concealment. And he dwelleth in desolate..." Excuse me, I'm sorry, I wanted to do the title bit first. Once again, The Boss in the Wall, a treatise on the House Devil by Avram Davidson and Grania Davis, read by Goblin Hood. "And he dwelleth in desolate cities and in houses which no man inhabiteth." Job 15:28. To say that the office looked dirty and shabby was to say that water looked liquid and wet. Newspapers, documents, magazines, clippings, files and folders lay stacked and slipped and scattered. Someone was thrusting his hand into a large manila envelope. Someone was turning the pages of an old illustrated publication. Someone was going through a scrapbook, moistening loose corners with a small glue brush. On one webby wall was a sign, "The contract never expires." None of the men was working hard or working fast. None of them seemed interested in what he was doing. And whatever they were all doing, they gave the impression of having been doing it for a long, long time. 1. What Larrabee's got. The not crisp card read, "Edward E. Bagnell, Professor of Ethnology, Sumner Public College." Curator Larrabee of the Carolina Coast Museum looked up from the card. "Still sticking to ethnology, are they?" His tone was civil, even amiable, but there was a something in his eyes beyond the usual mere shrewdness. "Yes, sir, they are. Still sticking to public, also." Bagwell was sure there was something sticking to the curator's manner. Inside the ruddy, well-worn face, lurking around the corners of the well-trimmed gray mustache and the picturesquely tufty, silvery eyebrows, the curator asked a few questions about Sumner Public College. Was McCrae getting on with his study of so-called Moorish mountain people? Was SPC having the usual small college trouble with trustees who wanted more money spent on football than on music, say, or scholarship, real scholarship? Then there was a pause, and then the odd expression ceased to be odd at all and was now plain to see. Slyness. And with that came the very slow, very quiet, "Well, what can I do for you, Professor Bagnell?" Out with it. "I understand that you have a paper man here under lock and key, Curator Larrabee." At once. "Yes, I thought that was what you..." "Don't know how I knew, but I..." "What did you say?" The slyness was gone. It was quite gone. The ruddy face was now quite red. The slightly jowly mouth hung agape. "What did you say?" "A paper man, or paper doll man. a hi-hat, or header, or header, a greasy man or string fellow, a rustler or clicker or clatterer, and or other names, though I assume, I'm sure you know. For a moment, silence, then an audible swallow, a shake, as though the heavy aging body had been set slightly askew and needed to be set right. A shudder, and then the slumped old man said, "This assumption cannot be allowed to get into the newspapers or the newsreels. This..." The newsreels? Bagnell had never seen a newsreel any more than he had ever seen a passenger pigeon or a Civil War veteran. Oh, God, no, that's the last thing we would want. The effect was galvanic. The curator was on his feet. "I require another name, and then we'll see how sure you are that I know." Bagnell said, "The boss in the wall." Larrabee was out the door before Bagnell was finished, but he was waiting in the hall. "I was, as I said, sure that was what you wanted, young man. Pardon me, Professor, but I figured you'd go about it slyly." The older man put his arm through Bagnell's, and the gesture at once dissipated all mistrust. "I'm taking you to the top of the tower. It's up these stairs, and I may lean on you quite a bit. No elevator. Slowly. Good?" The stairs were swept clean and smelled of old wood and polish, but as they went up higher, a strong odor of disinfectant became predominant. "And if you had, why, I'd have hustled you right out of here. And here's the key, Dr. Bagnell, the first key." Inside the tower was a locked room which required a second key, and inside this was a modern steel cabinet with two keyholes. Alongside it stood an open jug of creosote. "Tower door locked behind us? Make sure. Lock this one and swing the night bolt, too. Now, got a strong stomach?" Bagnell said that he had helped to find and bury hurricane and flood victims. He now noticed another odor in the rather small room, a strong one, entirely different from the tarry reek of the disinfectant. "Had such experience? Well, useful. Don't say it's better, don't say it's worse. Different. Clean different." He was gently inserting a key. "But not clean. God, no." He looked up, withdrew the key. "Oh, forgot. Got a handkerchief? Put some of that bay rum on it. You may feel that you want it in a hurry." On a small table in the corner was, of all things, a bottle of that once widely used gentleman's lotion and hair tonic. Bagnell had thought it had gone out with newsreels. Was that the source of the other odor? God, no. Bagnell obediently scattered some spicy bay rum on his handkerchief. Larrabee had the second key in and out. Inside were two perfectly ordinary large cardboard cartons with laundry soap logos on them. "Two? I thought there was one." "Think twice. There is." And so there was. It was in two pieces. The trousers and jacket were antique and dull with dirt and some sort of grease. The words "corpse fat" came swift into Bagnell's mind. On one bony foot, and it was as though the skin had been scraped thin before being replaced over the bones, and the skin was filthy beyond anything he had ever seen before, was a part of something doubtless once a shoe. The jacket was torn, it was worn torn, and it was ripped torn. And beneath it was part of a shirt, and the shirt part was worst of all, for it must have once been white, no other color could have become so ghastly gray, and here and there were stains of other colors, though none was bright. Breathe through your handkerchief, and don't get too close as you lean over it. Bagnell obeyed, though not before an accidental breath gave him knowledge of the actual smell. A breath was enough. It was not what he had imagined it might be. The smell was organic, he was sure of that, but it was nothing like any organic, or for that matter, inorganic odor he had ever been exposed to before. It was worse than mere decay or decomposition, worse than any disease, worse. He had covered his nose, but he could, even despite the scented distillation of the bay and the thick, rank creosol, taste it. He covered his mouth as well. Pieces of shredding, yellowed, filthied paper poked out here and there, from under the ragged ankle edge of the trouser cuff, from out of the gap where the fly had been. The tattered paper protruded like a codpiece. Worn and stained paper formed a sort of ghastly lace, jabot, high in front, and all of it that he could see showed awful and ugly stains, and even some of the stains had stains. Larrabee took up an exceedingly long pair of rather odd tongs and turned the upper torso half over. It must have been very light for him to do it with one hand. Look there. There was an immense hole beneath the left shoulder blade, and it had been stuffed, there was no other word for it, stuffed with paper. Larrabee said through his own handkerchief mask, "Of course, we never attempted to examine all the paper, but I can inform you that it seems to consist mostly of the special election supplement of the New York Herald of November, whatever it was, 1864, which proves nothing. Old Greeley shipped his weekly edition all over the country." Bagnell's eyes were darting here and there, noting the claw-like hand encrusted with far more than a century's, perhaps, filth. Noticing the rubbed-out part of the sleeve from which protruded a something grimy and grim, which was likely an elbow, not noticing, "The head's not there." "Oh," Bagnell's eyes were again darting. "The head's not here, is what I mean. Don't bother looking for it. Seen enough?" Bagnell thought he'd probably seen enough. "But I've got a photograph of it downstairs." And Larrabee went to locking up the cabinet. Then Bagnell let them out. Then Larrabee locked up behind them. "A photograph of the head. Want to know what the fellow said? The fellow who brought the body to us? Do, eh? All right. Steady, going down is not so easy for me as some might think. Said he saw it, that thing upstairs, saw it lying on the floor of a certain old building. Said he saw a rat scuttle over and start to gnaw at one of its feet. Said, you ready for this? All right. Said he saw the thing catch the rat with its foot. The thing's foot. Said he saw it jerk the rat up and heard the rat squeal. Ever hear a rat give a death squeal when some gaunt old tiger she-cat with a dirty kitten catched hold of it? And he said that thing, old boss devil, began to eat the rat. That dried up old horror, supposedly dead 100 years, with flesh as sear as a mummy's, began to eat the rat. Could it happen? God, no. Did it happen? God, yes. As for the head, It was a good photo. The mouth was still mostly full of teeth, visible beneath the writhed-up lip, and seemed to Bagnell very capable of clicking and clattering, and perhaps of killing a rat, a very large rat, too. The nose was sunken, but was by no means gone. Something had happened to one ear. How many times might it have offered itself as bait for rats, if rats were what it wanted, lying on rotting floors and rotting buildings by moonlight, or in moon dark, in forgotten tumuli, behind now vanished pest houses. Something had happened to one ear, and one eye was closed, but one eye wasn't. It was likely no more than a trick of the light, but the eye seemed to be looking watchfully out of one squinted corner. The eye seemed to have a very definite expression, and seemed, as such things often will, to be looking directly at Bagnell, who did not in any way like the look. It was not what Bagnell would think of as fearful. The look was what? Sly. He shuddered. Curator Larrabee, once again, just another on the way to being old man, said somewhat smugly, "Ah, now it catches up with you. Here, something I keep on hand, case of snake bite. Have one with you." After the first sip, the second sigh, the curator said, "Save you the trouble of asking. No, you may not have a copy. Want a photograph of the head? Direct you to Dr. Selby, Abbot Silas, scholar, rogue and thief, and most unworthy damned Yankee rat and rascal, holder of the magniloquent title of Principal Steward of the General Museum of the Province of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. Details on request, some other time. Further questions, brief ones." As Bagnell made a last and fruitless look toward the flat and locked steel box with the photo of the paper man's head, and made to go, one further question came to him. Larrabee made no objection to answering. The man who had brought in the thing upstairs, in two pieces, plus the head, brought them in a gunny sack. The man was a well-known manslayer. Had killed two Negroes. Well, was tried for two. Half-black, half-Catawba Indian. A musty, we used to call them. And after he'd done a year or so in the penitentiary, where, by the way, he behaved himself, and I'm sure no one stole his cigarettes or tried to commit a crime against nature upon him. Oh, no. Well, while he was away, there'd been some breakage here, theft and vandalism. So we pulled some strings, got Musty a parole by offering him the job of second night watchman, midnight to 8 a.m. He looks like Australopithecus maledictus, and you may be sure that no one comes around here now who's got no lawful business. Musty has no morals, no religion, feared of nothing, keeps his contracts. Gave him 100 silver dollars for his find and a big bottle of overproof rum. Maybe I'll give Musty a ticket to Providence, Rhode Island. Think about it. Larrabee thought about it as he reached for a lamp. Let me put some more lights on. Old newspapers, yes, indeed. Keep out of the cold, they do. Wonder what you'll do next time you hear a rustle in the dark. Your life has been changed forever. Well, nobody twisted you on your arm. You can always sell insurance. Mind your step on your way out. How did Musty kill those two Negroes? Larrabee, winding a light scarf, looked at him eye to eye.
"Broke their necks," he said. "Quote me for one single word in print about this. I'll ruin your career without compunction."
And that was the first time Bagnell actually saw one. So he informed his friend, Dr. Claire Zimmerman, when he called her later that day. In the past, that call would have been heralded by the almost necromantic words, "This is long distance calling." But neither of them remembered that, and neither had seen a newsreel. The past was sending them different messages, far more distant and dangerous. Excerpt from the Interim Committee Report. How many appearances, or maybe we should say sightings, have been reported, would you say? Asked Branch.
Don't know, said Bagnell. Define your terms, said Claire Zimmerman. How reported? To whom reported?
Well, it should be possible to find out. That would help combat it, wouldn't you think? Asked Branch. Do we even know, for instance, how many authenticated cases there are of one of them doing actual bodily harm to a human being?
How authenticated? By whom authenticated?
Oh, there are accounts, sure, bite wounds and scratches mostly, and talk of festering and amputations, said Bagnell. We just don't know. We think the boss in the wall is scaring us. Maybe he thinks we're scaring him. How many of them are there? We don't know. Do they know we're onto them and that we're after them? Can they communicate with each other? Do they? We don't know. Are they suffering from some kind of unknown virus? And if so, is the disease still spreading? Has it infected and infested some of the filthy derelicts we see lying in the doorways of old buildings? Are the drifters sliding and sickening and deteriorating into paper men? We don't know. What's it all about? And what can we really do except burn down every old house in the country? Two, the old house. The new house was very old, and Elsabeth Smith and Professor Vlad Smith loved it at once. Partly they had come to see it because of the cottage cheese fight of the people next door, and partly it was because of Uncle Mose, that fine old rogue. College residence building number 3 had been, like all Bodley colleges, new residence buildings, military housing during the war, the war, World War II. A duplex, was Elsa Beth's first exclamation on entering her and Vlad's new home, a brave cry which ignored the stained walls, leak-marked ceilings, pokey kitchen and warping walls, and doors and window frames. The buildings had not been built to last. They were, in fact, not lasting. They were decaying fast, but people still lived in them all the same. And among the people were the people next door, Professors Albert and Anna Murray, husband and wife. The Murray marriage was not going too well, and a hearty sneeze penetrated the thin partition between the two families.
Smell this,
Anna Murray, coming out on the porch.
Throw it out,
Albert Murray, nose in paper.
Throw out a whole carton of cottage cheese.
Don't throw it out then,
damn it!
Albert bellowed. Inside their house, Vlad and Elsa Beth's four-year-old daughter, Bella, says softly,
Albert and Emma are fighting again.
A slight and sallow child resembling her father, not precocious. She has her ways, what child has not, and the mere way she has of standing in a doorway with a wry, dry look on her small face makes her parents wonder how the doorway ever existed before Bella came to stand in it. Her parents do not directly reply. They consider their options.
The rents in quaint old Bodley City are out of sight,
sighs Bella. She was once a strawberry blonde, but since Bella... Sighs Elsa. She was once a strawberry blonde, but since Bella was in utero, Elsa's hair has darkened to a light brown. Her face, with its slight suggestion of a double chin, looks very thoughtful. She is a talented painter, and she is very nice. Not long thereafter came Uncle Mose's letter. Uncle Mose wrote,
Moses Stuart Allenby is looking around for a sponge to throw in. I am tired of robbing widows and orphans, and I am going to make you kids an offer. Elsie Bessie knows I'm quiet and clean in my habits. Mostly I sit in my room studying subversive publications like the Wall Street Journal, play a little jazz on my gramophone, take walks and watch birds. Want to relax at home, but must have a home and have no desire to sleep on your sofa. So here's the offer. All around small towns are perfectly suitable houses which never appear on any real estate lists because they are too old and unfashionable. Beware of Grecian pillars. Cost another 50 thou, and who needs them? Here are the magic words. A quick sale for 25,000 cash. Your local land agent will blench and swallow nervously. Then he will run around like a roach in rut season. You'll be surprised how fast he comes up with something usually thought unsaleable. Old, old houses are solidly built, or they wouldn't have survived to be old, old. Uncle Mose was a farm boy, built and repaired many a barn and old house before leaving on the milk train to the city. Uncle Mose will leave lovebirds alone to Bill and Coo, and will often babysit little Bella, teach her to play poker and dance the hoochie-coochie.
There's the house, Professor, to the right, said Realtor Bob Barker with a toothy smile.
The words formed in Vlad's mind. That house wasn't even built in the 19th century. He saw a small replica of Andrew Jackson's Hermitage, with squared wooden pillars, lacking even a lick of plaster, holding up the veranda's second story. Not Grecian at all, just an old, old house that George Washington never slept in.
Let's go in, if you folks are ready, Bob Barker said.
They were ready.
Got to tell you honestly that this house is almost devoid of your modern conveniences. No electricity, no telephone, but no problem there. The lines run right past the place. It's well water, but the pump is inside the house. There is just merely one bathroom, and it empties into a cesspool. Watch out for the far end of the porch. Got a rotten place there.
The key kept in a niche in the wall, in the sill, was modern. That was perhaps the only thing which was.
I love it, said Elsa Beth. I love it, said she.
Uncle Mose came 2 days later.
My God, Uncle Mose, said Vlad, what is that you've got with you?
It was gray with reddish lights. in its pelt, and it was huge, and it panted at them and lolled its tongue.
It's big as a cow.
Bella said, That's no cow, that's a big dog.
You're right, little belly. A St. Hubert hound named Nestor. Fine with kids, but burglars watch out. Where's some iced tea?
Where's our new house? Settle down, Mose, he advised himself.
Moses Stuart Appleby had been rather tall, and his shoulders still hinted at broadness. He was, as always, immaculate.
I'm all packed and weighted and ready for freighting, soon as I'm sure. Ready to go? I'm ready to go. Let's fill a big thermos with iced tea, Elsie Bessie.
They stopped in town for him to mail a letter, and an aged black man rose to confront them in clothes washed threadbare clean.
You the folks buying old Rustler House nigh the river? Was that its name, Russell? I didn't know that, said Vlad. It's on Old River Road, though, yes.
The old man nodded. His skin was gray and his eyes were glazed with age.
That's it. I born here. Call me Papa John.
Can I pleased to give you folks some kindly advice?
They is three warnings. Firstly, get you a cat. They hates cats. Nextly, keep you a fire. They feared a fire. And lastly, please, folks, never get between one of them and the wall.
He nodded his ancient head. Vlad, understanding not one word, thanked him and went on into the post office. And then the town sped by in a country lane with old oak trees dripping Spanish moss.
There it is.
Uncle Mose looked and said nothing until they went up on the wide veranda which ran all around the house.
Hey, look there. A tree, a lilac tree. Some old-time housewife planted a lilac bush, and now it's grown taller than the house. Well, let's open her up.
Faint broom tracks showed that some attempt at house cleaning had been made more recently than the planting of the lilac bush. Faint tremors and echoes in the old, old house. How old? Maybe in the title deed, maybe not. Were the Russells that old? Papa John mentioned the original owners? What was Uncle Mose doing? Uncle Mose was leaning over with his ear against the wall. Catching Vlad's questioning eye, he gestured for Vlad to do the same. At first, Vlad heard something like the sound of the sea in a seashell. After that came fainter and odder sounds, a rustling, a far-off clicking. A breath lightly brushed his neck and Vlad jumped. It was Uncle Mose.
Hear anything?
Rats, maybe.
Rats don't rustle. Rats don't click. We'll put out some rat traps, then we'll see.
Attempts, rough and rude enough, had been made to keep the old house in order. In one room, the ancient roses of the wallpaper bloomed faintly, almost evoking a ghostly perfume. Elsewhere, the walls were papered only with yellowing, tattered newspaper. In one large closet,
Whew, kind of musty in here, said Vlad.
Who is right? Worse than that.
Dead rat under the floorboards or inside the wall?
Uncle Mose shrugged.
Old houses, Lord, how they retain. Maybe the moldy diapers of a baby who died 100 years ago. Well, no problem. Open all the doors and windows. Have the place scrubbed down from attic to cellar.
Back home, and effusively greeted by the great hound Nestor and by Bella, fresh and pink-cheeked from her nap. They had drinks, they discussed the house, they all agreed they loved the house. Discussion had reached a pleasantly high level when there was a piercing scream. Tonight, at the Murrays, it was Anna's turn to scream. Vlad hastened to speak.
Say, why don't we have a cookout somewhere, a picnic?
Oh, good, said Elsa. Hey, why don't we have it at the new house? Then Elsa had her great and wonderful idea. Why don't we sleep out there tonight in sleeping bags? To celebrate, I mean.
All in favor, say aye,
directed Uncle Mose, and he insisted that everything was to be his treat, and they got lots of everything. At the old house,
the steaks are doing just fine, said Uncle Mose. I want to check something out. Bring some flashlights and come along.
He walked into the house with long strides, and what he wanted to check out was soon revealed.
Nothing in this trap, nothing in that one. Let's take a look in the cellar. Nothing. Traps are clean as a whistle. As near as I could see, there isn't a rat in the whole place.
Elsa said, of course, that she was delighted to hear it.
And I'm pleased to see how thick the walls are. It'll stay cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter. My mother always said that high ceilings and thick walls are healthy.
Nestor moved his huge head delicately. Nestor had been doing his own checking out and was still alert.
Bella said, this is our new house.
The grown-ups were pleased.
Yes, they said, this was their new house.
Without changing her slow and level tone, Bella said,
I don't like it.
Then she repeated,
I don't like it.
Nor did she say any more.
When the steaks were ready, they took their seats on the front steps. The steaks were tender and very, very good. Later, upstairs in the rose-papered room, sleeping bags side by side, Elsa said,
you know, for an old bachelor, my uncle knows a thing or two. The gentle way he convinced Bella to share the downstairs room tonight without a single protest. He must know this is a sort of special honeymoon thing, you and me.
Brad did not immediately answer.
He rolled over so his sleeping bag slightly overlapped hers.
Your place or mine? He whispered.
Afterwards, Vlad went down to use the antique toilet behind the stairs. The door of one room opened a crack, lamplight and shadow.
Vlad, said Uncle Mose.
The door opened wider. The great St. Hubert hound appeared, his master close behind him.
Would you be kind enough to let Nestor out the front door for a minute? Same errand as you.
Let him back in when you're ready. Didn't want to leave Bella alone in case she woke up. First time in a strange house.
Sure. Let's go, Nestor.
The dog came forward, gave Vlad a sociable sniff, waited until the front door was opened, and ambled off into the night. Vlad turned back, flashlight in hand, toward the water closet under the stairs.
Oh, by the way, Uncle Mose, that funny sound we heard that time when we were listening at the wall, the rustling and, clicking, I heard it again a few minutes ago when I happened to have my ear against the floor.
Look into it in the morning. On about your business now. Your wife might be nervous alone upstairs. Good night.
The older man nodded, retreated into his chamber. Those two words were the last ones Vlad would ever hear him clearly say. The plumbing rushed and gurgled loudly. Vlad stood by to make sure the ancient equipment suffered no overflowing, then went to the front door. Nestor appeared at once.
Good boy.
Light still showed beneath the closed door of Moses' room. Then the things began to happen. In what order did the things happen? Some things happened simultaneously, and there was no time to pause and think. The first thing was absolutely astonishing in itself. Nestor flung himself into the air absolutely vertically. His feet even left the floor. Then he hurled himself, still upright, against the closed door with the crack of light beneath it. Before his immense body slammed against the door, Bella began to scream in a thin, and terribly high tone, which Vlad had never heard from her before. At once there was an answering scream from Elsa upstairs, and, more or less at the same time, Nestor's body slammed against the door. Uncle Mose roared, and his feet ran, tramping inside the room, which had gone dark. Nestor howled and tried to break down the door. Vlad flung himself upon the door and fell against Nestor instead. He tried to hold his light steady, to see and grasp the doorknob. Still, Nestor howled. Still, the old man stumbled inside the closed room, and still Bella screamed. And the door opened, and Vlad staggered into the room and tried desperately not to lose his balance. The noises Uncle Mose made were not roars any longer. Uncle Mose it was who staggered, lurched, fell upon his back, and rolled to his side. Bella had stopped screaming and was utterly silent. Nestor flung himself across the room, and the house shook. Elsa came screaming in, and then she did absolutely the worst thing she could possibly have done, and somehow Vlad knew absolutely that she was going to do it. She seized the arm of the hand in which he held the flashlight, and she tugged down on it as she called her daughter's name, and the flashlight swung wildly up and down until he managed to get it into the other hand. Nestor was throwing himself against the wall and clawing at the wall, howling and slathering, and something fell from his mouth. Vlad reeled as he tried to dislodge his wife and to focus the flashlight. Then Elsa let go of Vlad's arm and ran to pick up her child, who was arching and thrashing and kicking and making sharp howling sounds. Elsa picked her up, but Bella's arms and legs still moved and jerked convulsively. What else was in the room? Something else had been in the room. Someone else had been in the room. Something, someone, filthy and frightful and foul, had been in the room. There to one side was the Coleman lamp, and Vlad forced himself to calm his hands and to relight the lamp, and the room filled with hissing light. No one else and nothing else was in the room now. Still, the huge dog flung himself against the wall. Then it stopped. Bella stopped her frightful convulsions. She hung limp in her mother's arms, even when Elsa had fallen on her knees onto the sleeping bag, pressed her ear against the tiny chest, lifted her horrified face to him, and nodded slightly. Nestor stepped delicately on huge feet to his master, nuzzled him and licked him, and began to utter a deep and moaning lament. Was the old man dead? Vlad slowly got down beside the body and said, "Uncle Mose? Nestor? Uncle Mose?" Slowly he placed his ear against the fallen man's chest. There was no rustling sound he heard, no clicking. He heard no sound at all. Nestor sniffed again and began to howl. The long, slow, cold nightmare continued. Call the police, deputy sheriffs, sheriff's deputies, the hospital. Well, it's shock, basically. Your little girl is, of course, the most affected, but your wife, too, is in shock. I'm afraid you aren't in too good shape yourself. Take these. Sign these. Tell us again, Professor, exactly what happened. Questions asked by the doctor, by the doctors, and by the police. Shock, Professor. Your only child has ceased to be a little girl who stood in a doorway and turned your heart with a single look. She became a wind-up doll which screamed and thrashed, except when the doll wound down and looked dully out of unfocused eyes. Shock, to use simple language, short circuits the nervous system. What did she see that caused this shock? What sort of creature, sir?
It is difficult for us to believe, you see, because your wife doesn't report anything like that. Don't be offended, sir, but you too have suffered a severe shock of some sort.
What the hell, Branch? What the hell?
Brad's old friend and fellow professor of folklore, David Branch, looked at him and said, "Nobody knows what the hell, Vlad. We have to take this one step at a time."
Why was Uncle Moses' funeral and cremation over so quickly? Why was his collar so high?
Then another thought sprang into Vlad's mind.
Where's Nestor?
He's at Dean Jorgensen's farm. It's in the next county, so the sheriff can't get him to shoot.
What? Why would they shoot Nestor?
Well, mainly because they were afraid of him. That this great brute was leaping around, terribly upset, and next thing a deputy got the idea that, well, maybe Nestor had killed the old man. Impossible? Why impossible?
I told them the dog wasn't in the room when it began to happen.
Well, they didn't know that, and I heard that Mose had some sort of marks on his throat that might have killed him, so anyway, Nestor ran off, and Dean Jorg heard about it and called the trembling beast into his van and drove him across the county line, so Nestor's all okay. What next?
I want to go back to that damned old house, and I need some plastic bags.
At the supermarket, leaning on the back of a superannuated cart containing aluminum cans, empty bottles, and odds and ends of light junk, was someone whom Vlad recalled meeting. Remembrance was mutual. Stopping his wagon, the old black man said,
"I'm sorry, sir, about you, daddy."
Why bother with a correction? Vlad nodded, sighed.
"Must be you daddy forget. Done get between it and the wall. Fine old gentleman."
Vlad stared. Remnants of thoughts came whirling by as if caught in a gale.
"What do you mean, Papa John? Get between what and the wall? What wall?"
The age glazed eyes and the furrowed face looked at him.
"Them bad things, as we find sometimes in old houses, them rustlers or clickers, them paper men. The boss, sir, the boss in the wall. How the lady and the lee girl. The boss done stole the lee girl's soul, and you got to get it back."
He pushed off, leaving Professor Branch looking after him, leaving Vlad with his mouth twitching.
"Did you understand what old John meant, Branch?"
"I believe I do, which is not to say that I believe it as facts."
"I should tear that damned house apart, find evidence."
They drove beyond the small town and along the country road. The old house looked far different in late autumn sunshine than it had at night. In the room where Uncle Mose and Bella had cheerfully agreed to spend the night lay a well-worn red rubber toy. Vlad pointed out to Branch a portion of the wall deeply and recently scored by talons.
"Those are Nestor's claws, I guess."
He put his ear against the wall, heard nothing.
"It's hollow," he said.
"It would be. Proves nothing by itself." Vlad abruptly said,
"Ah, that's what I came for."
He pointed to something in the corner.
"It was in her hand, and she dropped it when I picked her up."
He took the plastic bags out of his pocket. Branch knelt and looked. Then he sniffed. This time it was his face that writhed. "Paper. It looks like old newspaper. Well, this is an old house. What a god-awful stench. You say it was in your wife's hand?"
"No, it wasn't my wife," said Vlad,
as he carefully used one plastic bag
to scoop the object into another.
It was my daughter who had it clutched in her hand. It was Bella.
No further search could legally be made of the house, and no walls would be torn apart. According to the sheriff's department, the deceased died from a stroke or a heart attack, possibly following an attack by a dog or some other animal. Case closed. At the hospital, Elsa woke up and took a light supper. Then she slept again. Bella's condition was unchanged. Elsa's aunt, Uncle Moses' sister, invited them to stay at her big house in the country after they were released. Elsa softly told Vlad that she thought the change would do her and Bella good. Vlad reluctantly agreed.
"Jesus, Branch, what should I do?"
said Vlad when they returned to college housing.
"It is my belief that Uncle Mose died of a severe bite in the throat by some sort of degenerate or derelict creature, for lack of better words. And that's what terrified my wife and daughter and messed up our lives. That's what I told the doctors and the sheriffs, and nobody believed me. No autopsy was done before his body was cremated, and..."
"Do? Well, the first thing to do is take Dr. Branch's prescription of a big drink of whatever booze you have on hand, and then you are going to lie down and pretend to sleep. I will put on some sleepy-type music, and, I'd like to look through your files. I promise not to read any love notes or old paternity warrants. I want to look for learned matter. Folkloric shop stuff, okay?" Pretending to sleep was, as expected, succeeded by genuine slumber, then by awakening and finding Branch reading by lamplight.
"What's that you're reading, Branch?"
"I thought you'd never ask." He tilted up an old red folder, mended with tape. "Look familiar?" Vlad felt that it did look familiar, that he knew what was in it, and somehow he did not like what was in it. He recalled a small voice saying, "Is this our new house? I don't like it." He leaned his head on his hand and choked back tears. Branch shoved the folder over to Vlad, who slowly opened and leafed through it. What was this on yellowed paper, laboriously typed in old-fashioned typescript?
"Transcript of alleged rare pamphlet, allegedly entitled, The Treatise on the House Devil."
And this, a sheaf of sundry papers, typed and penned and machine copied on various sorts of copy machines, attached by a large rusting paper clip, and labeled Bagnell's Notes. An item caught his eye.
"Preliminary survey of the folklore of two Ohio River tributaries."
I had the usual difficulties. First you must find your source, then you must make him talk, then you must make him stop talking. Or her. In fact, it was from a her that I learned a folk remedy for pubic lice, which is too gross for learned journals. Also, I heard the following account, which might interest you. Near a place called Wide Waters, where two large boats could pass each other, was a tower. It was originally as tall as a three-story building, but then kind of crumbled. Some say it was used as a shot tower or a lighthouse. Others say it was built by a wicked Frenchman to remind himself of France. He was cruel to his slaves and nearly starved them to death. Well, as soon as Lincoln freed the slaves, they mixed up a big batch of cement and carried over a big pile of stones and walled their evil old master, their boss,
inside the tower. Then all the former slaves ran off. There were no windows in the tower, just little slits. And before anybody came around and found him, long after he must have died, they say he got so thin, he was able to poke his hands through the slits and wave them around. And they say you can still sometimes see the skeletal hands of the cruel boss in the wall waving through the slits on stormy nights. You can recognize elements of countless old world legends of cruel leaders walled in towers, such as the Sultan of Baghdad and the Mouse Tower on the Rhine, though the skeletal hands waving through the slits may be strictly a local touch.
Okay, Branch, okay. I got it now. I remember.
Vlad wept.
Why didn't I remember it before?
Branch had poured moderate drinks for both of them from a bottle, sipped his own, and gestured to his old friend to do the same. Here's a possible explanation. Why did you originally forget it? Because you forgot, that's why. Who the hell remembers everything? Every wife in the world feels compelled to shove some of her husband's old crap out of sight. And you had other things to do, so you forgot. Then you went to the old house, and just the sight of the place, or some little sound or smell, started to bring back memories. But you didn't want the memories. You and your wife and uncle wanted the old house, and the memories weren't very nice, so your mind suppressed them until that moment. Let's say that your uncle had some kind of stroke or fit of convulsions. He couldn't breathe, so he clawed and tore at his own throat. Suppose your daughter woke up and saw him, and she started to scream and scream. Branch took another sip and continued. Suppose that what you saw was so terrible your mind couldn't admit that you saw it. You had to be seeing something else. Your mind, so to speak, slipped down into the sub-basement. And there in the mud and jumble, your mind found something. It found those old tales that old Papa John had babbled about, and it substituted those old terror tales for the terrible thing you were really seeing. All of this in an instant, of course, but the memory lingers on. Maybe your little girl's defense was to retreat into convulsions and unconsciousness. Vlad groped for words. He felt as if he were on the edges of a deep, dark wood.
Is that what you really think happened? That my buried memories of all those damned old legends made me think I saw?
From outside the dark woods came a deep sigh. That's certainly one explanation, and I advise you to consider it, said Branch, tossing down the rest of the whiskey. Later, much later, Vlad's breath came softly and regularly from the couch. Branch slipped silently out of the room, took up the telephone, and walked as far into the kitchen as its long cord would allow. He turned on the light and a water tap, then dialed a number. Waited. Dr. Edward Bagnall, please. Hello, Ed. This is Branch. Yes, I know what time it is. Have a pen and paper? Okay, listen. Carefully. The house devil. Paper man. Boss in the wall. Well, I want to report another sighting. Three, Vlad's quest. How sweetly the small old town smelled in the early summer rains. It seemed to smell of cedar and citronella and water and mint. Annie Jenkins, Dean Jorgensen's housekeeper, said, "Was it one of those tramps, one of those awful ones? The Lord knows where they come from or why. Luckily, not often.
Oh, they don't do anything violent, not lately. They don't even steal, the ones I'm thinking of. We used to call them paper men when I was a girl because they put newspapers under their old clothes to keep warm in winter. Though, why in summer? Don't even steal, which is very odd if you think of it. They being so poor, they can't even afford soap or secondhand clothes. Oh, those filthy rags, just the sight of them. Oh, and the awful smell of them. I asked my husband what causes them every so often, you know. Harry said it was some clearance. Harry says some awful old abandoned building is torn down somewhere, and then those dreadful derelicts have no place to hide, and so they just wander off. They shamble around, and sometimes they turn up here. Thank the Lord they don't seem to stay. I have no idea where they go, but they don't stay here. Was it one of those? And to think of the sheriff accusing that sweet big dog. Why, when you gave him a shirt his old master had worn, Nestor took it to his bed in the barn, laid the shirt on the straw, and rested his head on it all that day. Dean Jorgensen said, tapping his huge hairy fingers on his desktop,
"Well, good, Stuart. I told Vlad he could take the summer off if he took someone with him. I'm glad it's you. He likes you, says you have a good mind and a good sense of humor. Fortunately, this is still a private college, and I can finagle you some graduate credits and something out of the special funds without having to justify it to 6 state legislative committees. Consider that done. And you, in turn, won't let him get morbid and obsessive about..." He searched for a word, gazed at Jack Stewart with troubled eyes, and concluded, "It." Vlad looked as if he was fairly well recovered from a bad drunk, but Jack knew that if you looked it, you weren't recovered at all. It wasn't until they were bedding down for the first night in a worn-down motel that Vlad began to loosen up and talk.
"I understand Jorg's going to do some creative bookkeeping and get you some grad credits. Good. Officially, we're going on just another fun folklore ramble." He ran his fingers over his tired face. "Good, clean, bright stuff. Children's jump rope jingles. Paul Bunyan tales of the lower Appalachians. Old darkies stories about Mr. Buzzard. But unofficially, you are going to be my keeper, eh? Well, that's we... That's you, kid, are going to keep me, that's me, kid, from getting into anything gamey or gritty. No folkloric spelunking, but no such luck, kid. God bless poor dear old Jorg, but I'm going after such little-known legends as the Clickers, the Rattlers, and I don't mean snakes. I mean the greasy man, paper man, the boss in the wall. See?"
Jack Stewart ran his own fingers through his molasses-colored curly hair, murmured about a shower, looked up and asked, "Why?"
"Why? Because I saw a specter haunting an old house, and it killed my uncle and sent my little girl into convulsions and my wife into a deep depression, and my God, it was awful. Why was it there? What was it? What is it? Nobody believes that I really saw it. Hardly anybody in academia even knows the legend, let alone perceives it, let alone believes it. Albright does. We're going to see Albright. I've got to find out more about the legend, more about what I saw. I've got to find something that will help my wife and my daughter, help us put our lives back together. Bagnell knows about the legend. We're going to see Bagnell. And after that, well, we'll see. See?"
Stewart, in turn, liked Vlad's mind and sense of humor, but now he saw a man slumped in unhappiness, confusion, pain. There was much that he wanted to know about what happened, much he dared not ask, which he knew would be revealed later. So he merely said, "I see." Vlad kicked off his shoes, rapidly undressed, said he was too tired for a shower.
"Have one in the morning. Too tired even to put on the jammies. Maybe I'll put them on in the morning, too. Going to stay up reading? Try the Gideon Bible, Job 15:28, as a starting text. Leave the light on in the bathroom if you like. Night."
Jack turned on his reading light. Gideon Bible? Well, there weren't many things you could do in a motel room. Job, huh? 15:26-27. Ah, his finger traced its way to the verse. 28.
"And he dwelleth in desolate cities, and in houses which no man inhabiteth."
Jack Stewart decided to leave the light on in the bathroom. Robert E. L. Albright lived amidst the dense green kudzu vines, way away from anywhere and very far away from the highways. The hand he held out was large and reddened and splotched, a description of his face as well. His eyes were red-rimmed, and he blinked a lot.
"I hope, Professor, that you may have had my letter?" asked Vlad Smith politely.
Blink, blink.
"In which I said that I'd like to talk with you about the possible origins of the legends of the paper man or the boss in the wall."
Blink, blink. It was not clear if Albright had led them into his office or his dining room. At one end of a table strewn with books and papers, a late teenaged boy was sitting beside a sort of barricade erected out of old law books, eating breakfast cereal and milk.
"My grandson, Albert J. S. J. Albright. In theory, he is reading law with me. When he is finished, he will be a foremost authority on the foreclosure of mules."
His voice had fallen into the flattening tones of the increasingly deaf. The boy slightly turned his head and raised his hand to it, as though to wipe away Rice Krispies, and, looking straight at Stewart, said, low-voiced,
"You got a joint?"
Stewart opened his mouth to reply, looked at his elders, and turned his own head slightly. The boy got up and shuffled dishes.
"Go get you some coffee," he said.
"Give you a hand," said Stewart.
"Well," said Albright, "I got your letter. Where did I put that shoebox?"
He rummaged among the many shoeboxes and other things on the table.
"Put it. Floor sand shoes here."
He took up the shoebox, turned it over. A sheaf of typescript settled on the table. Inasmuch as the width of the average shoebox is somewhat less than that of the average sheet of typing paper, someone had neatly trimmed the papers. The idea had something of the simplicity of genius.
"Here 'tis," Albright said. "Here 'tis, a true account prepared from the original testimony of the capture and death of a paper man on the lands and domains of Jim Oglethorpe Albright, Esquire, as edited by his grandson, Professor Robert E. L. Albright, with notes and commentaries. Sorry I don't have a clear copy to give you. Like to look at it?"
"Well," said Vlad, slightly bowled over, "I'd like to, yes. I'd like to talk with you about it. I'd like you to tell me about it, if you don't mind."
Albright said,
there was mighty little to tell. He was located, as my diagram shows, my map here, he was found in one of the old tobacco barns we used to have, and it was set fire to, and he was seen as he ran off, and he was tracked down. My great-grandmother was at hand, and she rallied the Negroes, and they behaved very bravely, yes, sir. My grandfather was at war at the time, and his old mother guarded the fort, so to speak, and gave them courage, because generally speaking, they would have fled like deer from such an apparition. Who could blame them?
Who indeed, thought Vlad bleakly.
As it was, they stoned him with stones until he died.
What?
Old Albright slowly nodded his massive, mottled head. It is what happened, Professor Smith, to be sure. He looked at Vlad directly. There were skeptics, aren't there always? Some of them said he was a Union prisoner escaped from Andersonville Prison. Prison camp, we would call it nowadays. Some said that was why he was so gone. Well, no one denies that Andersonville was very bad. What comes of putting a Dutchman in charge of things, a Switzer Dutchman, starved his prisoners, the scoundrel, went back to Switzerland during the war, went and returned by running the blockade. How much you want to bet? He put a lot of money in one of those bags over there. Jack Stewart and the younger Albright returned, carrying a tray with coffee and mugs, which they set on the table. As for the other skeptical account, why, some said that the creature killed was a Confederate deserter who had stripped off his uniform so as not to be identified and had taken up some rags of old clothes from who knows where, maybe from a farmhouse in the middle of a battlefield. You know, there was an old farmhouse right in the midst of the Battle of Bull Run, and an old lady died in that house during the battle, and who knows what went on in there. And as for the creature's gaunt condition, maybe he hadn't eaten well while he was hiding and skulking. He was discovered in the tobacco barn, and tobacco is a filthy weed. I like it, but it's not nourishing, which might explain his extreme thinness, and if hunger left him too weak to bathe in a creek, his extreme filthiness, if the explanations of the skeptics be true. I have offered this fully documented account to no less than 14 publications, and would you believe that 10 of them decisively declined and that 4 did not even reply? Jack said rather abruptly, "If you tell it, sir, I would believe it, otherwise I would not." Vlad also looked surprised.
"I should think that such an account of the myth in action would be very acceptable, considering the historical period, and from someone of your stature in the field."
"My stature in the field, well, well, blink, blink." His reddened face grew redder yet, but his voice remained flat. "If you had spent as much time in the groves of academia as I have, it would perhaps surprise you less." He poured coffee. Later in the car, Vlad said,
"I don't mind telling you that I was feeling just a bit spooked."
The kudzu vines sped by, sped by. There seemed to be hardly anybody around, and the few people they saw didn't seem to be doing anything. Surely they did not, could not, eat the damned stuff.
Know what you mean, Jack Stewart said. What did you think of that boy buried alive out here? No wonder he couldn't think of anything except grass.
Well, you can't smoke kudzu.
You said a funny thing. We were sort of rapping about that in this. Well, I did most of the talking about old Paper Man. And he said, you know, Larrabee's got one locked up, don't you? And I said, no, who's Larrabee and what's he got? And then he took a long toke and he said, well, if you don't know who Larrabee is, then I don't know what he's got. Vlad said,
we can ask Ed Bagnell at Sumner Public College.
And then conversation faded away in the face of endless green tangles of kudzu, kudzu.
Dr. Edward Bagnell was on the telephone. Dr. Claire Zimmerman, please. Claire, Ed, do you have your little slate and pencil there? Okay, listen. On whatsoever excuse, I want you to go to Rhode Island and see Dr. Silas Abbott Selby of the Providence Plantations Museum. This refers to the Paper Man Project. It's of gross importance and intense confidence. You will go and question Selby about a rumor that he has a paper man's head. Don't scream into the phone, for God's sake. Heard it from curator Luke Larrabee of the Carolina Coast Museum, who has Selby in the sights of his parrot guns. That's confidential. I doubt if one visit will get you a peep, but be prepared to keep at it. It may require a slightly less severe costume and manner. That's up to you. That's all. Kiss, kiss. Silas Selby had another view of the matter. He sipped Fundador and looked at Claire over the rim of the glass. Her cropped dark hair framed her round face. They were in the W. Waldo Brown Room, endowed by the philanthropist of that name, some said in order to have a quiet place to drink brandy without his wife.
Larrabee has no training as a museum specialist whatsoever, he said flatly. He was an architect and sort of a house doctor for old houses, patching them up, I mean. By and by, he began to do work for the old museums down there in Carolina. Well, they were short, all kinds of trained people, and he was a quick study, enthusiastic, and willing to turn his hand to anything, willing to read up and become the local authority on anything. Just the sort of man they needed when the curatorship fell vacant.
Selby sipped his brandy, gazed at Claire, and let his eyebrows rise and fall.
Well, somehow or other, Luke had acquired a local mummy. Antebellum, postbellum, or just plain bellum. There are places throughout the world where the soil tends to preserve bodies laid to rest, and such bodies sometimes turned up down Luke's way in places unexpected. I think they became sort of cult objects. Who can say why? People went mum when one asked, and people looked at each other out of the corners of their eyes. Local name for them was paper men or paper doll, because the local lovers of grue and ghoulishness had been in the habit of padding their wasted bodies with old newspapers under the clothes, which made them look less gaunt and skeletal, chests less fallen in, stomachs less shrunken, and so on. The ancient Egyptians used small sacks of cedar sawdust for the same purpose, after all. It is reminiscent of old Jeremy Bentham, stuffed and mounted and in his best clothes, attending the annual meetings of the whichever society. Now, perhaps I should not be telling you all this, Dr. Zimmerman, may I call you Claire, but I feel I can count upon your... He peered at her again over his wine glass. She assured him again that he might count on her. More brandy, Miss Zimmerman, or a biscuit? Very well, though I hate to be a solitary drinker. Selby sipped his own. I was visiting the provincial museums and had to go about checking it ever so circumspectly. Couldn't come right out and demand to see it. Well, Larrabee kept that paper doll thing hidden in a Rinso box in a broom closet. It was in three pieces in totally deplorable condition. A great troll of a janitor was lurking around. Details shall be spared you. Luke, confound it. This should be kept in a moisture and temperature-controlled sealed case. Couldn't agree with you more, said Larrabee. Then why isn't it? Haven't got one is why. Besides, our fragrant friend might spook the city senseless. And there should be a series of tests made, examinations, measurements, tissue samples. Let me give this some thought. To make the matter short, a complex plan was worked out. Some recently acquired shekel medallions would be sent to Larrabee as sort of hostages, and the head of his precious mummy would be sent north to Rhode Island to be tested. Teeth, for example. Meanwhile, I looked into getting a proper sealed case for it, but after a very short time, old Luke Larrabee began demanding his, object back, and making ridiculous charges that the shekels weren't authentic, said the shekel medallions of 18th century European manufacturer had been represented as actual 2nd century shekels of the last Jewish Commonwealth, which was certainly not stipulated in the agreement, said his miserable mini-museum had now provided a more secure repository than the broom closet. Well, the tests take a long time, so Silas Abbott Selby stood firm. The empty glass came down firmly on the table, and his eyes firmly held Claire's. And I am not likely to yield, my dear Miss, my dear Dr. Zimmerman, for in strictest confidence there is a great deal of mystery about this whole thing. The tests are inconclusive, but I can disclose that the tests show no traces of such chemical embalming agents as arsenic or formaldehyde or anything more modern, though what they did disclose was both interesting and puzzling. Certain tissues are inconsistent with the state of certain sinew fragments, soft tissue, brain matter, and spinal matter, epidermal cells. But I have no wish to be prolix. Oh, the press would like nothing more, nothing better than to compare us, by us, I mean the Carolina Coast Museum and the General Museum of the Province of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, compare us to Burke and Hare. Ha ha. Oh, surely you need not rush away now. A glass of Fundador? Do let me pour you. Our Fundador is famous. Well, I have very much enjoyed, and should you just hear any of ha-ha-ha Curator Larrabee's, he has no degree in museum science, you know, of his complaints against this ancient and august institution older than our republic, well, ha-ha, just consider the source. Allow me to help you with your wraps. Well, good night, Miss Dr. Zimmerman, Claire. In a semi-senile tortoise shuffle came Dr. H. Brown Roberts. Who was that young woman, Selby? Surely you are not entertaining a personal female guest in these semi-senatorial chambers endowed by Uncle Waldo Brown, eh? Looked like a flapper to me, eh?
Framed in the arch of the ancient gallery, Dr. Roberts wagged his snowy head. His white thatched nostrils gleamed.
Well, I suppose it doesn't signify. I'm only old Harry Roberts, and I don't signify, though I am still on the budget committee. I guess I know a flapper when I see one, and I know a good bottle of Fundador when I see one, so pour me a glass, Silas Selby. Call me a Brandy Baptist if you like. What care I? I'm only old Harry Roberts, and my years of labor don't signify. Pour me two glasses of good Spanish brandy, or I'll tell the budget committee about your stinking old head, and what will they say about that, huh? Ha ha. Tell you I know a flapper when I see one.
Edward Bagnell, doctor of philosophy, friend of Dave Branch, and holder of other distinctions, greeted Vlad Smith and Jack Stewart in the elephant room of Sumner Public College's Museum of Ethnology. The elephant room contained a rather large and awful oil painting of the progress of some Hindu Maharaja, the gift of a long-ago benefactor. The painting's cleaning was fiercely resisted on the grounds that it was best left obscured. Bagnell waved them to a large leather sofa. I dare say you'd like to know why it's Sumner Public College. Everybody wants to. I am able to dispel the mystery. The founding fathers and the one founding mother put the word in to show that the college was a serf to neither church nor state, as some still are. How do you like the elephant room? It looks like the antechamber of a rather seedy club. But here, the Department of Ethnology holds out by being part anthropology, part folklore, and part whatever. We claim to have pioneered the interdisciplinary study, ha! And here is where the ethnologists gather to drink embalming fluid, as wine is only allowed on campus for certain ceremonial occasions. How is Albright doing? Stewart took the reply upon himself. Old man gives the impression that he's mostly letting the kudzu grow over him, but he isn't, really. And the boy makes cryptic statements such as, Larrabee's got one locked up. He repeated what he had told Vlad and concluded, You have any idea what that means, Dr. Bagnell? Ed Bagnell shrugged. Probably that Larrabee, whoever he may be, has a report on the legend and is keeping it locked up until he's ready to publish. Typical academic paranoia, eh, Vlad? After answering no more than a grunt, Vlad slowly began to speak of his own and immediate problem of encountering by moonlight in the old uninhabited house something so hideous, noisome, foul, that he might have thought it was madness to think it was real, only to find the sight so real as to drive it.